You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Stormy Weber. She's talking to me from Seattle. Stormy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much, Brainerd. Thank you so much for inviting me. Really appreciate it.
So I know you're going to read some poems today, and we're going to talk about your work. But perhaps before we talk about that, can you define a little bit the perspective you're coming from, which you describe as two-spirit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, two-spirit is a term, an identity that is an indigenous identity that has existed for thousands of years, and it fundamentally means that the person has both a male and female spirit within them, and travels through the world in that manner. And there can be other aspects of the identity, as I understand it. Everyone would have their own definitions, but as I would understand it, that the person has perhaps some ceremonial roles to play within the culture. The person has ethical responsibilities to behave well and to work on behalf of the community, particularly the vulnerable. And those who need help. So, say the elders, the children.
This is a kind of, as you say, indigenous peoples, specifically a Native American idea?
Specifically Native American, yes. It is a specific identity that is rooted in Native American tribal cultures. So it's not just like, you know, oh, I'm gay or I'm a lesbian, which I am a lesbian as well, but it is specific to the culture. So
go on. I'm just wondering, at that time in the culture, did that also, maybe the term gay or lesbian wasn't used, did it also mean that, or was there a kind of sexual identity component of two-spirit necessarily, or no?
Well, as I understand it, and I myself am studying as well, because I grew up in this Western culture of the United States, so I didn't grow up in our traditional cultures. But as I understand it, people can be two-spirit without being lesbian, without being bisexual even. It is a spiritual identity that can include, as I understand it, the sexual identity and sexual preference identity. So, and as I say, I'm not an expert, but I do feel that I live the life, so.
And is that because of who your parents are also? Does that play a role in this identity? I mean, it must, mm-hmm. in part, right?
Well, I mean, in my case, it does, because my mother was a lesbian who was a mixed-blood Sukpiak, which is Alaska Native lesbian, who came out in the 1950s. And my father was a bisexual man. He was Black and Choctaw from Texas. And he also had come out in the late 50s. So I would go back another generation to say, I am, what I understand in my family, I'm the third generation of two-spirit, of a two-spirit identity.
Because both your mother and father, in a sense, were two-spirit.
Right. And then if I go back.
They were each two-spirit, right.
Right. And if I go back to my grandmother, I would say she was as well, although she wasn't a lesbian. I could see that she had both spirits within her as well. So I would say, for me, it's definitely a family lineage. But, you know, of course, it's just part of my discovery as I do my work, because my work is rooted in restoring a lot of lost narratives from the marginalized people of my family. So the more I research, the more I go back and study and feel into returning those lost words, the more I understand.
Well, I want to hear some of those words. Of course, I know you're going to read poetry today, and I look forward to that. And discussing the work you do. Also, your name. Can we talk about your name, Stormy Weber? Is that mm-hmm. your given name, or was that also something you gave yourself?
Now, Stormy is my given name, and I was named by my first and greatest mentor and teacher, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, I was born when my mother was quite young. My grandmother was really only, she was young herself. She was only 35. So it is traditional in a lot of indigenous cultures that the grandmother plays a large role in the raising of the baby. And
wow.
That happened blessedly for me. So she actually named me. And there's an amazing story that she told me. Her sister was married to a Sicilian-American man, and they lived in a certain part where there were a lot of Italian-American people living. And she was there visiting one day, and she saw a woman gallop by on a horse. And she had long black hair, and her hair was flying behind her. And she said, "That woman is so beautiful. Who is that?" And my mother's cousin, her niece, said, "That's Stormy." So that, I'm named after that Italian-American woman. I'm a
wow.
black Alaska native, and I'm named after an Italian-American woman who was galloping by on a horse. And because, I mean, my grandmother was such an artist. She didn't obviously have a lot of opportunity to express that within herself. But she introduced me to art. She taught me about art. She taught me to read. And she was struck by that image. And she gave me that name. And in indigenous sense as well, you name the children with holding in mind some qualities that you would like to pass to them for life. So I feel that she did that very intentionally.
I love that because it also, I mean, for me, that there's a different, what I associate with the term, spirit is slightly different, but that, the spirit of, you know, this woman riding on a horse, I imagine her galloping by with hair streaming behind her, is also an incredible spirit, right? I mean, I see that as also a kind of, interpret that partly as energy, a way of being, right? Kind of extraordinary.
I absolutely think so. And, you know, because even today, the experiences of indigenous women are really, really, really challenging. And my grandmother was born in 1922 in Alaska. So she had a lot of, you know, a lot to contend with in her life. So I definitely understand from her that that was intentional. She wanted to pass down some strength and in hopes that, you know, my life would have improvements from her experience, which it absolutely has, and quite a bit, if not all of it, is down to her. It's down to,
well,
you know,
I'm so glad we
lesson.
Talked about it. I'm so glad we talked about it. And I want to hear one of your poems because, of course, that's what that's what you've done with this inheritance,
absolutely.
With this spirit, with these two spirits. You've been writing and teaching. So, please read a poem and tell me what this first one is from.
Okay, so I have a book of poetry and some of my archival photos that is available, and it's called Blues Divine. There's also a companion CD, and they can be ordered through my website. So this poem is entitled Grace. So I'll just read it, and then we can speak on it. Grace. Grace, ease on over me, because I live in music, and you can find me there in the discordance and confusion of everyday life. I'm there in between a blue note and a new note. I'm there. Grace, ease on over me. See me and fall all over my everything, for there is nothing you cannot stand or understand. I trust myself in your hand. I can rest easy because I know you love me. You always loved me. Through the bitterest seasons when rhyme left me stranded, you walked with me full of feeling and spoke in total silence. I swear, Aretha Franklin has saved my life more times than I can count. And if Billy sent me sometimes to the 57th floor, but she'd always find a way to sing me down. I could glide down easy on Charlie Parker with strings and find myself in April in Paris. And somehow at those moments, nothing else mattered. At those moments, nothing that is not music can touch me. Spirit swathes me like impervious armor, and I understand what keeps me living. You see, it's the sheer goddamn funky swing of it all, the mystery at the heart of it, and at the end of the road. I understand why Nana played that record, Songs to Torch By. Now, torching is not a widely known about thing anymore, but those folks knew. They knew how to get a misery out of you before it became fatal. Why, just roll yourself in it and let the tears and rage flow out. Let Billy carry that cross for you. She already died for your sins, don't you know? So when I get the lowdown miseries, I reach for the tried and true soldiers of survival. And they come, singing and moaning and falling out and getting back up and exhibiting so much class and grace and style. Till after some time, I feel my soul stretching and straightening up, filling my living frame, and I once again rejoin the human race. Music is my mistress, and she and I will never part.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I love that poem. I'm so glad you read that one. It begins, it's a nice way perhaps to set the tone for the other two, because music and your writing are always and forever linked, it seems. Is that correct? It's such a huge part of your life, as you're also making clear in this poem.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. My grandmother, her favorite singer was Billie Holiday. And, you know, I was born in 1959, so actually the first song I learned was Hit the Road, Jack. So, right? Yeah, it's funny. So I can kind of, in a way, they were a bit omens in my life because of the Hit the Road, Jack. And then the first 45 record I bought was A Girl Named Sue. And the first album I bought was Ode to Billy Joe. And so it was all sort of, I became captivated by these stories, you know, these songs that told stories and the lyrics. And my grandmother would sing. And so this was the beginning of my study of art. So the music is intrinsic to all the writing I do. When I write, I listen to me. To me, I'm listening for the rhythm. I'm listening for the spirit in the writing. And even my study of art, really a lot of the study of art was through practice, traveling, working in New York, working in London, working in Berlin, working in Hamburg, and connecting with artists from around the world and just making. So that was much more of my study than going to art school. I went to art school later. So
tell me a little bit, I want to hear another poem, but I also, mm-hmm. you know, you said the first single you bought, it's really interesting hearing the first records, right? And I was going to ask about, you know, April right. in Paris, but the first single you bought was Ode to Billy Joe.
The first album, yeah. The first single was A Boy Named Sue, which is a perfect two-spread song, right? I laugh right. when I think about the way that, you know, the way that the things that we love explain our lives. I think it's kind of amazing.
It is interesting. So then if you could explain a little bit to me about your, in defining two-spirit, you also mm-hmm. say Choctaw. Choctaw, maybe I'm saying that wrong. And if I remember mm-hmm. Correctly, the words to Ode to Billy Joe, that's also in there, isn't it?
Exactly, it is in there, and I did not know, and I don't have, you know, I don't have documentation about that. It is different when you have a tribal identification and you're registered with the tribe. That information came from my grandmother, my father's mother, and
what information exactly?
That we also were had Choctaw heritage. My father's mother. Were black people mixed with Choctaw. My grandmother came from East Texas, and we come from Arkansas and Louisiana area. So that's based upon my grandmother's information. But yes, it is interesting that I was so fascinated and I was drawn to that name, and I didn't know why. And I think that happens a lot. A lot of my work is based upon a relationships that I have with my ancestors, and reverence that I actually have for my ancestors. And so that has inspired me to want to tell their stories, to want to restore their stories, you know. The other aspect of growing up was that my mother was lesbian. And so, in addition, I grew up in the pre-Stonewall lesbian gay community in Seattle. So, you know, I grew up on so many margins. And those intersections, I think, are give the work a certain kind of energy and power. My largest project thus far was the solo exhibition at the Fry Art Museum called Casino, a Palimpsest. And that show specifically examined, you know, all those liminal identities and how they intersected and how they informed one another and what they had taught me, as well as restoring those lost narratives.
Fascinating, yeah, because that's also, I want to hear the next poem, but that narrative, which is of that particular song, and we talk about misery and difficulty and children, the ode to Billy Joe is a very difficult and kind of seminal song that I haven't thought of in a long time, but it seems not just to be about perhaps, you know, race relations in the United States, but also teenage angst and misery and suicide, of course. You know, that's a pretty
when you listen to Bobby Gentry, she really always emphasizes that the main point that she wanted people to take away from that was this level of denial that the parents had. I've read that from her several times. For her, it wasn't important whether Billy Joe killed himself or threw the ring or any of those details that people ask about. But she was pointing at this, and I mean, we can look at that for the present situation that we have, that we have people in this country that are just, like, willfully ignorant and want to deny reality or deny, like, an actual living presence in the world. Or any sort of empathy.
Pass the biscuits.
I mean, we're there. they're passing the biscuits again.
The peas. That's great. That's great. It's very powerful. It's so true, and still, you know, rings so true today. That's kind of fascinating. So tell us. I'd love to hear another poem. What are you reading next?
Right. So this one is. This is a story of the city of Seattle, it's funny. I think it's funny, and I write a lot about the working class community in which I grew, and the cross cultural community in which I grew. So it references specific places and experiences in Seattle. It's called Hit and Run. Bobby King tried to kill me before I was born. My 18-year-old mama, big-bellied and crossing the road. Bobby behind the wheel, rolling past the famous Birdland where Jimmy learned to burn. Flying high while driving. Bobby wheeling too loose, too far, too fast. Bam, knocked my poor mama through the air. Shock, crash. Hit her, though she must have tried to protect her baby. I survived 8 months and counting till my 9. She broke her arm, shielding her seed. Instinct won over ambivalence. Oh, it was a knockout. Cars can still panic me till now. I don't drive and can be a nervous rider as much as I do love the road. Mama, Nana, and me were at a Ray Charles concert. Ray was his blue-black genius self. The Raylettes sang and shimmied in those skin-tight sheath dresses, and it was solistically wonderful. Mama suddenly spied Bobby King in the crowd and shamed his styling frame by saying real loud, "Stormy, that man tried to kill you." He smiled real nervous-like and slunk away with the quickness. The other thing I remember is waiting backstage for a long, excited, hopeful time with my program in my little hand for Ray's autograph. A great, big, blustery white man looked down at me and said, gruff as could be, "He can't sign nothing. He's blind." I watched him scrawl Ray Charles himself and fling the program back at me. Fly forward 10 more years. I'm now 18 and a young lesbian wannabe player. I've just seduced my former caseworker and am lounging naked and brazen on her bed. Suddenly there's frantic, desperate knocking at the door. It is one and the same Bobby King, her recent ex, who dogged her out and is now begging, "Baby, please. Sleep." He never knew that the girl child he failed to annihilate with his half ton of U.S. steel was at that very moment upstairs, busy rocking his cradle better than he could rock his cradle himself. Life sure is funny, ain't it? Maybe. Unless so Bobby King.
Thank you. And of course, that poem is quite different than the other. Before we read the next one, tell me a little bit about that, because this of course, is more autobiographical, correct? This is about yourself.
Yeah, it was just a funny story. You know, it was just a funny story about life. And the thing about, I guess it's an indigenous concept of time, but maybe other cultures have it as well. This idea that time is not linear, that it is actually very round, and that at times you can look around and imagine these moments, and they're so connected. Like, to me, it was funny that someone who literally could have killed me before I was born reappeared in my life because I was dating his ex-girlfriend, you know. So then I said, well, was he trying to kill me so this wouldn't happen? Was he taking revenge in advance? Like, how does this work out? It just somehow, I thought it was funny. And my mother was funny, you know, to embarrass this man because she had that sort of funny sense of humor. And Ray Charles was a very, very important artist in my life, you know, and in the life of my family. I feel that music was a really powerful healing force within my family, because it was very challenging to grow up in, you know, to have a lesbian household. We were only women. My grandmother was divorced. The Sipaya culture is actually matrilineal, so we were in our tradition. But, of course, we're dealing with this Western culture here. As I've gotten older, I've come to feel at this point that what was different about us was actually really a source of strength, because we were never a part of this sort of idea of the American dream. We were excluded because we were just too odd, but that is a benefit to me at this point. As we go through this tumult, as we go through this, you know, exposure of the really destructive aspects of this myth, I feel unnecessary and appreciated freedom from the indoctrination that could have happened had I been born into a different situation.
So let's hear one more. You have one more to read us, right, from the same book, correct?
Yes. So this one is called Ode to Blues. And this poem, again, is about the music. This one is particularly about the healing and transformative force of blues music, which arose from African people who had been kidnapped from their home and forced into slavery, and also developed through the interactions and involvement of other peoples, indigenous people. You know, some of it is influenced by European music, but Charlie Patton was black and Cherokee, and he's called the father of the blues. So this one's called Ode to Blues. Safe thus far, the blues has brought me through. This I know to be true. Yes, it was nothing but the blues. Yeah, the gut bucket stomped down. Shoot out the light. It's too damn funky in here. On blues. The well is so real, motherfucker. What's thrilling you is killing me. Blues. Cause your world is like mine, blues. Reaching back to where in Africa a moan rose and spiraled into a wail across the Atlantic to this strange land where we were enslaved and our drum outlawed. Fools never thought to be concerned with what they called darky songs. Too simple to know what those songs were telling us. Who was running that night? When? Where? How? Blue gospel told us what we needed to know. Steal away, steal away, steal away. Oh, I ain't got long to stay. Oh, yes, we did. And not to know. Jesus, let us now praise the blues. Deep, deep, deep in the dark of the darkest night. Barefoot through the swamp, can't see your hand in front of your face, neither that cotton mouth easing up on your sweet baby girl, knowing that Harriet kept that pistol at hand for the weary and the fearful. Why, nothing but the blues could tell a body how to go on through. Don't say nothing to me about pilgrims or pioneers. I got your profiles, encouraged my fellow Americans. That soul music was comforting, winding, rolling, soothing through our spirits somehow. Now most would have just lay down and died, and you know that is the stone truth. Paddy rollers on horseback in hot pursuit, hounds just baying, and those hoops and hollers those white men had let out when they get to thinking about the reward money, or how much somebody called a likely wench or a strapping buck might fetch at auction. Now as if slavery wasn't enough, as if manifest destiny wasn't enough. Surely that would be more than sufficient to make a body feel the lowdown blues. Start those blues, blues flowing just like that Ohio River we only had to get across to freedom. So all's I can say is hail the blues, queen bee of music, mother of all North American music, roots. Blues, hey, you made a way out of no way. Blues, oh blues, you made my back strong, my heart not fall splintered and tore up out my chest, my feet take that one more step. Oh, if ever a song could rise and take form, it would have to be you, oh blue, black, mighty, mighty tone, the way you held me. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Oh, no, no, nobody but you. Yeah, hollering like a mountain jack. When I hear you, I know you. And I know I'll be all right by and by, same way you held my mama and hers before, and all reaching back in your eternal arms. Blues, I love you. Be you moan, shout, shuffle, or stomp, I'm there. Turquoise, lapis, sapphire, indigo, sea and sky, let me count the ways you appear in my heart, and to my wondering eyes and ears, I feel you, O song of my deepest soul. Rising from back, way back from Africa to Houston, Texas, plain dealing Louisiana, Mississippi, and let us not disremember sweet home Chicago. I say, come on, baby, don't you want to go to where the blues amplified itself so as to rise above the din of the L train, the stockyards, and the steel mills, home of storefront churches pumping blue gospel, or is it gospel blues, onto the urban prairie and the juke joints, just a juking on, and the juke joints, just a juking on. Why, before we ever marched with eloquent signboards, Muddy threw back his head and roared, yeah, I'm a man. And Miss Coco Taylor pitched her wang dang doodle set all night long. Listening from a place deep inside, where the tone meets the note in love with candlelight warm, meets the note, encounters the rhythm in a sweet sway of step. Hold me in your arms like a voodoo child, baby. Oh, blues, I love you, and I don't know why I say, but I swear I'm gonna love you till the very day I die. Let us now pray. The blue.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm so glad you read that poem and sang it. And I think what I want to ask you about that poem, since you read it so beautifully, and one of the things that, you know, when I interview poets, I love to hear them read. It's often so different than the reader might approach it. And, of course, in the reading of this poem, even more so, right? It was a beautiful performance. You're singing. It's so evocative, you know, how you read it. That's quite different than the way it might be read in your book, right, by someone else. I guess what I'm asking is that kind of split. And on one hand, like, I always feel, gosh, poets, it's so important to hear them read because they do it so differently than we might, and it gives the reader insights into how they could be reading it or imagining it or thinking about it. But how do you feel between the kind of difference between how you read that and sing it and how the typical reader might read it when picking up your book?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm always working cross genre. So I've been working with poetry and music since the 70s, 80s. That's when I began combining a cappella vocals with my poetry. And when people experience my work, for example, with the Casino Project, which is still in process, is going to be traveling outside of Seattle. I'm in process of working on that sort of a touring project with Casino. A Casino was cross-genre. It was grounded in the poetry, and the poetry, of course, is also woven with the singing. So there was audio installation of this work that I've just shared with you. There was the centering of the story of the mothers, conscious centering of the story of the mothers, and that is the indigenous mothers and the black mothers of my lineage. And archival photography from my personal archives and from state archives, right? So that's how I tell stories. I feel like I can't, it's not in my nature to tell a story in using just one strategy. So I don't know if that answers the question, I can't think of the poetry without the music. They're woven together, because the poetry, for me to work, it has to have that feeling. It has to have that emotional reach in order to communicate what I'm trying to say.
Right. And that makes sense. Well, thank you for that. And let me ask you one more question. What are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious.
Right. Well, of course, we just lost Ntozake Shange. So I am actually rereading her novel, Lillian. I've been listening to some of her conversations, and she cited that as her favorite book. So I went back to that. She also cited another book that I'm reading called A Woman is Talking to Death by Judy Grant. So I'm reading those along with a lot of other books, but returning to those. She was really a tremendous influence on me as well as so many other people, because I encountered the recording of For Color Girls, and obviously working with the poetry and the music, and the personal, telling the personal story, but in a way that makes it relatable and gives other people the feeling that their voice is also being heard. So, yeah.
So Stormy, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. It's really been a pleasure listening to your work and talking to you.
Oh, thank you so much, Brainerd. For me as well. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.